This is a Radboud Reflects podcast.
Welcome. My name is Kees Leijenhorst. Welcome to this evening. We're going to talk about the Anthropocene and not. We're going to talk about, are there ways out of the Anthropocene, the global geological era that's marked by human intervention on Earth, to actually the destruction of Earth. Is there a way out? Well, there's one philosopher, environmental philosopher, who actually thought there is, and that there is actually going to be, well, should be, a new era, the symbiocene, and the author of which, of this term, is Glenn Olbrecht, who is our very, very distinguished guest tonight. Glenn Olbrecht is an environmental philosopher, one of the most prominent environmental philosophers globally nowadays, from Australia. He flew into the Netherlands, has a jet lag, but everything is going to be all right, he assured us. And tonight he's going to talk about the subject of his book, which has very recently come out in Dutch, Earth Emotions. It's about emotions that we experience in the Anthropocene, negative emotions, but it's also talking about new positive emotions that we need to convert, so to speak, to a new attitude, an attitude that we need in order to transcend from the Anthropocene to the symbiocene, to a well living together with nature. But Glenn Olbrecht is going to talk about that a lot, is going to explain that shortly. We'll have a lecture by Glenn Olbrecht first, and then we're going to have a discussion with two philosophers, local philosophers from Radboud University, Elise de Mul and Boris van Meurs. So we're going to discuss the basic concepts that Glenn Olbrecht is going to put on the table here. I should end this brief introduction by saying that we have three partners tonight that are working together. It's Uitgeverij Noordboek, which edited the Dutch translation of Earth Emotions. By the way, the book is available right after the exit of this room, but I'm going to talk about that a little bit more at the end of this evening. ISVW, the International School for Philosophy, and the Friends of ISVW, the Friends of the Internationale School for Wijsbegeerte. Without further ado, I give the floor to Glenn Olbrecht.
Thank you very much, and it's such a pleasure to be in the Netherlands and to be part of Philosophy Week. I was joking with my friends, new friends, that we could fit all of the philosophers interested in my work in Newcastle, the closest city to where I was living, into one telephone box. So to have a group of human beings that are actually interested in the area that I work in is fantastic, and I feel very privileged to be here and to be a part of Philosophy Week, to be a part of this university, and of course to be looked after by Erno and North Books, and be part of the release of Earth Emotions in Dutch. So I'm going to give an overview of my work, and it'll be flat out because there's a lot in the book. I'm also a transdisciplinary thinker. That means that I tackle topics that I shouldn't really enter quite often. But I do it with great pride because I think I'm contributing a creative space where I'm welcoming others to come in. The symbiocene is a mega meme, which is inclusive of so many things that universities used to do, and I hope can continue to do well into the future. So it's an invitation to be involved in the creation of something which I think we absolutely need. And I'll begin to see how I can make the technology work. Is that working? Excellent. So Earth Emotions and the symbiose scene. What I want to do is connect the idea of emotions to the state of the earth, good or bad. And obviously we're at a time where most of us feel that our relationship to the earth has gone bad. Maybe not be for you personally, but for millions of people worldwide. We now feel that our relationship has turned bad. It's uneasy. It's causing us distress. It's making us feel very anxious about our futures. So people talk about eco-anxiety, climate anxiety, and a range of other feelings, some of which we as humans probably haven't felt before. So I'm going to try and give you an overview of those feelings. I'm aware that I'm looking at, or I'd like you to be aware that I'm looking only at a particular type of emotional slice. I'm not looking at all human emotions in all contexts. And in fact, that's the point of some of my work, is to say that the distress that we feel in the Anthropocene deserves a language and an evaluation of its own. It doesn't dismiss other forms of distress. It's just saying that we have a very powerful, quite distinctive form of distress that we need to address in our lives and in our work. So I have a confession to make. I love birds. I'm a bird person. I'm not a twitcher, so I don't carry a notebook and tick things. But I've always been infatuated with birds from childhood onwards. And the bird is there to remind me to talk about what I call a symbiography, which is a particular form of biography where we focus on the influences in your life from your first memories onwards that have shaped your particular feelings, attitudes about your relationship to nature. Now, maybe when you do a symbiography as an analysis, you'll discover that, well, I actually don't have much of a relationship with nature, which is a perfectly reasonable and respectable outcome. Or you might be able to identify that your grandmother helped you appreciate the exquisite beauty of native orchids in the Netherlands. Or that it may be that you read certain authors and certain books that provided you a framework to become somebody interested in nature at some level. So symbios in the Greek means companionship or living together. And I've used that word to describe the symbiotic relationships that are needed to create new entities. And so your own personal symbiography will be your own distinctive, unique analysis of your past. So anyone can do one. Some people find them revealing, interesting, challenging. They might even be useful in changing direction in your life. But I used it in chapter one of the book to illustrate how a bird-loving, nature-loving boy growing up in Perth, the most isolated capital city in the world, ended up writing a book about earth emotions. So it's not an obvious path, and there were certain things that I tried to explain to a reader as to why I ended up doing what I do. That alone, that chapter could take approximately 2 days to complete, so I think I should better move on. All right, the Anthropocene has been mentioned. I live in the Anthropocene in Australia. For the last 10 years, I've been living in the Hunter Valley of New South Wales, quite possibly the world's largest black coal mining area on the planet. Certainly, it's the port of Newcastle, the world's largest coal exporting port. As a result, I think I know what it's like to live in the Anthropocene, and it looks like that. That's part of the 500 square kilometres of open-cut coal mining in the Hunter region. One of the world's largest power stations is in the background. I had to take the photo through a barbed wire and chain mail fence. That's why it looks a bit vague in parts. And I had to take it quickly before the security people came and dragged me away. If you take a drone there, you're in serious trouble. They try and arrest you immediately. So I just took a photo through their fence, and even that was too much for them. And the reason why the photograph, I think, is important is it exemplifies the Anthropocene at its worst. this is an industry that pulverizes the earth. It crushes it. It mines the coal. It then drags the coal out of the ground with massive machines. It burns it in the local and regional power stations, and then it exports it to the rest of the world. So it's one of the most powerful transformational industries on the planet. It terraforms the earth. It reshapes it. It leaves a toxic legacy. And so if you want to know what the Anthropocene is, come and visit me in Australia and I'll take you for a sightseeing tour of one of the worst expressions of it on the planet. So from my experience of the destruction of the Upper Hunter, it was once called the Tuscany of the South, an indication of just how beautiful the place appeared to the early settlers. It was once the home of the Wanneroo people, indigenous people who lived in that area for tens of thousands of years before they call Invasion Day of the British colonists coming to Australia to set up a new settlement. So the experience of the coal mining, the coal chain, listening to the testimony of people in the area who said that the neighbour from hell had moved in. They had no power to stop the coal mining, probably similar to European law. You can mine under land or claim mineral rights, which override rights of private property and rights of even a degree of a quality of life that is certainly going to be interrupted by the mining process. So it put me on a path to think about, well, what is the emotional relationship that we have to the land and what have people said about it in the past? And, of course, as a philosopher, I didn't have any qualifications whatsoever to undertake that kind of sociological come anthropological study. But I started thinking about the fact that distress in English referred to a million different things. But here we had a form of distress being caused in farming populations. The indigenous people were already distressed because they'd been dispossessed and were still feeling the pressures of colonialism in so many different ways. But we didn't have a particular form of distress that was related to the state of the earth and our relationship to it. The closest I got to when I was first studying this was Hoffer, 1688, and nostalgia. So I read his PhD thesis in translation. So he was a physician, and he was concerned about nostalgia, which he created as a neologism then. And nostalgia was the homesickness, melancholia that you feel when you are absent from home and wish to return. There was a cure for nostalgia, which is to simply go home or be repatriated back to the fatherland, and you would be cured. He did describe the condition of nostalgia as both biomedical and psychological. It caused palpitations of the heart. It caused emotional outpourings. It was psychosomatic, but not invented. Psycho as in the mind, somatic as in the body, and the combination of the two, he argued, could actually kill you. So it was diagnosed as potentially fatal disease caused by absence from home and the overwhelming desire to be returned. I realised that in the Hunter Valley, the people I was studying were in a similar but importantly different position. They were at home, were being distressed by something which was being imposed on them, and their home was leaving them. In the case of the Hunter Valley, it was bucket load by bucket load of their own territory, their own land. And so I realised that the opposite of nostalgia was needed as a concept to describe our relationship to the earth. And that was the genesis of the concept of solastalgia, which I created in 2003 and was published from about 2005 onwards. As a result of solastalgia, and it has a career of its own, it's now 21 years since I invented it, I thought that solastalgia, as important as I thought it was at the time, must sit in a a whole list or typology of other emotions that are connected to the earth. And I wanted to know more about other people who had created negative emotions. And I wanted to test myself as to, well, have I really understood this turning bad of the relationship between a person who's living in their home or in their territory and the rest of the environment? And so there are Eric Fromm, necrophilia, just in case you're a bit worried about that. It's not what you think it is. It's a love of death generally and your relationship to life and living things. Biophobia from E.O. Wilson and Kellett. Global dread, which is one that I thought of when I was thinking early in the morning, having a conversation with my wife about the fact that everything on the news was just absolutely awful. And it's nothing compared to the news now. I mean, so dread is probably not even a strong enough word, but at least it's future orientated. It's not the lived experience of the now. It's the worry, the concern, the dread about the future. And Richard Louv with nature deficit disorder. Quite a few people came up with eco-paralysis at the same time, but it's that feeling that it's so overwhelming, it's so large, it's a Morton hyper-object that no matter how hard you think about it, there's nothing you can do to alter it, change it, improve it, or get rid of it. And a whole slew of new terms in the last few years, eco-anxiety, climate anxiety, eco-grief, lots of grief. So that's an indication that we're moving strongly towards more and more horrendous terms to describe our experiences of the state of the earth. And that tells you something about the need to do this kind of work and to expand on where we are. So the solastalgia, I'll just briefly say something about that in more detail because some of you may not have ever come across it before. So the bumper sticker version of it is the homesickness you have when you're still at home and your home is leaving you. Now, a home can be at various scales from what you're looking at outside of your lounge room window to the whole earth. And so you can think about a solastalgic relationship as operating at different scales in different places on Earth. The images of an open-cut mine in the upper Hunter region, the word open-cut must give you an impression of what this kind of mine is like. I can use my fancy little red dot. From there to there is 2 kilometres. From that side to that side is enough to engulf most of the campus. And that object there is an electric shovel, and it's one of the largest pieces of machinery on the planet. It's massive. And so it's now, that photo was taken in 2008. It's now doubled that size. So I got a grant, rented a helicopter, got a tame photographer, went up and took huge amounts of photos of what's going on up there because it's the only way to illustrate it. With 2 wonderful colleagues, Nick Higginbotham, a social psychologist, and Linda Connor, an anthropologist, we conducted funded research on people in the area to find out more about what they thought of their emotional relationship to the land. We interviewed an Indigenous man, and I won't read the quote, I just wanted to emphasise that he would drive hundreds of unnecessary kilometres to avoid looking at the area of his traditional land that was being mined. So repulsive was what was happening to the land that he felt connected to as an Indigenous person. He concluded by saying, "I can't look at it, it makes me wild." And what he meant by wild was, this is something that's so offensive to me and my culture that I can't look at it. And the artwork, which is on both the English and the Dutch edition, I won't get into the details of it, but a wonderful artist by the name of Kate McDowell created the sculpture for an article which was written on eco-psychology and the unconscious for the New York Times. And she was commissioned to do works of art to illustrate the eco-psychology, and she'd produced that one and called it Solastalgia. And I had no connection to her whatsoever, but there's a koala inside that porcelain head, and I had immediate identity with the skull and its occupants. It's also got birds, particularly parrots. I'm besotted by parrots. And so it was a perfect illustration about the mind, its contents, the earth, the state of the earth and biodiversity. And so I think it was it's wonderful that a concept like Solastalgia can start producing responses in the world of art as well as in the world of philosophy, anthropology, psychology, etc. That's the bad story. Now we can move. That's a koala on Wallaby Farm. Charismatic megafauna, we call them in Australia. Just lucky that a pair of koalas happened to live in the territory that my wife and I chose to live on. So what a privilege to have a wild animal like that living close to you. That one I called Fluffy Ears for some strange reason. And she is just the most beautiful koala on the planet. Right. So koalas are interesting because they eat gum leaves and they're not very active. But there's a whole ecosystem connected to them. There's one moth that lives only on the droppings of koalas. It's an interesting example of symbiosis, if you like, the moth also has some connection to bacteria, which are needed in the gut of the koala in order to digest gum leaves. And so there's this circle of connection and interconnection, which I think the term symbiosis conveys. And when I was thinking about the need to oppose the Anthropocene, I had this gut feeling that I wanted out of the Anthropocene as soon as possible. And that I'm the sort of person that's like, well, if it's that which I find so offensive, I need to think about its opposite and quickly, and it's a form of self-healing, if you like. I was really pleased to see recently that the geologists have refused to use the Anthropocene as a legitimate category in geological science. Well, I would have wanted to get rid of it anyway, but they've done the job for me. The one reason I want to keep it is because it's a mega meme that is being used by so many different people that it provides a useful comparison to that which I would like to see. And so in order to understand symbiosis, I had to do some history of ideas research. And as a philosopher, that's the kind of work that I find really stimulating. And of course, the Greeks created symbiosis. It's written in Greek. It's translated and transliterated, and it means to live together. It's a term that was applied in both biological and social contexts. Special relationship sounds like something like Putin would come up with, but it is a special relationship between unlike living beings, where there is some kind of crossover or mutual benefit for both parties. And this special relationship, as I said a moment ago, was applied not only in the context of biology by the Greeks, but it was also applied to the human community. So in biology, we have examples from the classic Greek writers of creatures like the fan shell of the Mediterranean and a crab that lived in close association. The crab lived inside the shell, and when a little fish would come inside the shell, it would pinch the sensitive organs of the inside of the shell. The shell would snap closed, and then they'd both feast on the fish. And that seemed to be a very happy relationship. And crocodiles love Egyptian plovers that take the leeches out of the dental work between the teeth, the gums. So a mouthful of leeches could be cleaned out by a bird. The bird gets food and blood. The crocodile gets a happy, smiley face. So they were aware that these relationships, early Greek biology, zoology thinkers, we're observant of those kinds of relationships, and they call it explicitly symbiosis. In human society, it's slightly more complicated, but nevertheless, we have cohabitation, social intercourse, meeting other people, communion and commerce, fellowship. That was another context where the word was being used. But also, intriguingly, the connection to more intimate relationships, sexual intercourse. And that was sometimes the same word for commerce. So you can see there's an interesting connection there between commerce and commerce. And marriage, wedded life, was described as symbiosis. And you can see the coming together of unlike parties to hopefully produce something which is of mutual benefit, and quite often a child or children. There seems to be a gap of a few hundred years, and we end up in 1622, somebody writing about commerce and patent rights in England made a contrast between the ownership of patents and inventing things for private profit, comparing it to the public symbiosis, which at that time meant something like the commons. And so the word didn't disappear. It just seemed to be lying quietly in the Dark Ages. And I have to add a little bit about the Dutch and their contribution because I'm in Holland. But I found this really fascinating, and I won't try and pronounce Anthony van Leeuwenhoek's name because I'll get it wrong. But he observed, he took scrapings from the scum on his teeth and subjected them to analysis under a microscope and discovered the microbiome of the human mouth, particularly that which surrounds the teeth. So a lovely reference that I had here was he was the first to observe microbial symbiosis. And of course, we've got microbiomes of the mouth, the nose, the ears, all the organs that you care to mention. There is a microbiome that's specific to that particular part of the body. So that work has now proceeded apace. And Maria Sibylla Merian, an amazing explorer, lived in Holland, was not necessarily Dutch, wonderful illustrator. She also paved the way by understanding that spontaneous generation was not a viable theory. Metamorphosis of the insect's life cycle was one of the first observations that she made. And so that's a massive contribution to a process philosophy rather than some crackpot theory about spontaneous generation. And the Germans working on fungi, and in particular lichen. The lichen is an association between fungi and algae, or fungi and bacteria, cyanobacteria in particular. Here's an association of two unlike parties producing a third organism which has properties that are not the same as the other two. There's something new under the sun being produced. And this was a revolutionary observation in the late 19th century. And to name that association, a couple of German mycologists worked on the concept of symbiosis. And Heinrich Anton de Barry in 1878 set upon the ancient Greek word of symbiosis to describe this new type of relationship that was being discovered in the microcosmos. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but if you go to the Concise Oxford Dictionary, you'll find that the way to spell and pronounce the sim of symbiosis, which is a German neologism created in 1878 or thereabouts. But if you want the original way to write it in English, it's symbiosis, S-U-M. And I know there are probably classicists in the audience that are ready to throttle me by saying that upsilon is always translated as Y, and so it goes on. But I had another reason for wanting a distinction between the two. One is to keep the science, the symbiosis in science exactly as it is, but to look at the application of the science of symbiosis to other domains, particularly social domains, I wanted it to be symbiosis. And so there was a reason for it, and I'm living with the consequences, which is possible confusion and accusations of being unfaithful to the linguists and classicists and all the others that accuse me of the sin of the error of transliteration. So I use symbios. It's in the symbiography, because it's the application of the ideas of symbiosis to your life history. It's not science. So that's one that can be developed over the next decade or more. And, of course, it wasn't just scientists that were doing this, and the idea of mutual connections and interconnections between life. People like Peter Kropotkin, Prince, Russian anarchist, writing after Darwin, challenging Darwinian theory on the basis that, yes, nature's tough, there's a lot of conflict, but at the same time, there's a lot of harmony, there's a lot of cooperation, and at least the cooperative side of life is important, and it might be as important as the Darwinian competition theory. So Kropotkin, this idea of the law of nature, sociability being at least as important as competition, was also something that was bubbling along at the same time as the evolution of the science of symbiosis. And for me, what's interesting is the continued development of the idea of symbiosis as the basis for a new philosophical look at the world in general, but life in particular. And the French scientist cum philosopher René Dubois wrote this in 1962. He says, the phenomenon of symbiosis has a significance which transcends analytical biology and reaches into the very philosophy of life. He's one of the first modern thinkers of the 20th century to think, look, these discoveries in biological science are so profound that they actually alter the foundations of how we would have any kind of philosophy of life or any more systematic thoughts about the meaning of life. And there are many others that follow. That list is totally incomplete, but you probably know yourselves, if you're able to transcend the Dutch context and look at, mainly in the English-speaking world, philosophers and thinkers that have contributed to what I call the symbiotic revolution, how to apply symbiosis as an idea in science to whatever else is going on this planet right now. And so you can read as well as I can speak, so I don't need to go through that list. And I would encourage you to add more to it, because I think the history of ideas deserves to be more thoroughly explored in this domain. For me, some of those thinkers were not available to me in English. So I first started thinking about the relationship between the loss of symbiosis in life and the state of the psyche when I read a woman's book called Soil and Civilization, written in 1946. She was a contemporary of Aldo Leopold. The book and the woman, Eileen Mitchell, is virtually unknown in Australia. And so she wrote during the Second World War. Her husband was fighting offshore, and she wrote this incredible book about the loss of soil fertility in Australia under European colonisation, the role that Indigenous people had in maintaining it prior to Invasion Day, and the idea that she put forward that caught my attention was this courageous decision to build civilization into a symbiosis with a revitalized world became my mission. she could see that we could reintroduce symbiosis as a theme to actually correct some of the errors that were leading to really practical problems like loss of soil fertility. So Eileen Mitchell was one of the big influences on me. And there's another obscure Australian that contributed an amazing contribution, which then flows through into Deleuze and Guattari, and her name was Edith Coleman. And this is just to put a bit of spice into this talk so you don't fall asleep. She discovered pseudocopulation of orchids by wasps. And this means that the orchid actually changed its shape to be more attractive to male wasps and exuded a perfume that male wasps found just irresistible. And so she corrected the past science and brought the whole area of pseudocopulation between orchids and insects into the scientific world. And of course, that became the basis of some famous work by Deleuze on the orchid and the wasp and concepts like deterritorialization, the slippage between spaces that we thought were well-defined but aren't, and the creation of new spaces that actually don't have boundaries or fixed meanings either. And that means that the discovery of something about the way the world works that surprises us, symbiosis between orchids and wasps, becomes part of a broader philosophy of life and of humanity, which becomes a massive part of modern philosophy. And the others you probably know about, Lynn Margulis. I consider her to be a tremendously important contributor to the science and the application of the science of symbiosis in the 20th century. She defined symbiogenesis, evolution by symbiosis. She defended that thesis at a time when it was not accepted in any way by the conventional science at the time. And also she was able to show things like chloroplasts and mitochondria as once free living organisms that have become incorporated into more complex organisms, and hence symbiosis is a factor in the evolution of complex life. And we've discovered a lot more since then. Like, we now know that part of our so-called junk DNA is actually the leftover bits and pieces of viruses that infected us tens of thousands, if not millions of years ago, not necessarily even as Homo. We could have and we discovered that viral relic is actually really important for the development of human embryos. Without it, all sorts of things go wrong. So Lynn Margulis reminds us that we're not individuals, we're holobionts, we're multiple species coexisting in the same time space, we're an organism that's consisting of small bits of humans that weigh a lot and trillions of tiny organisms like viruses, bacteria, fungi that don't weigh anything at all. One lot's visible, the other lot's invisible. And now under the science of symbiosis and the technological revolutions started by the Dutch and their microscopes, we can render the invisible visible. And that's transformational. We suddenly realise that we're not who we thought we were. We are indeed holobionts, and that people worry about the fact that humans put themselves up in opposition to all other life forms. But if we work the other way, we've always been more than human. We just didn't know it. And so that transforms our relationship to other creatures. It transforms our understanding of ourselves, creates a huge amount of new philosophy. And so the symbioscene comes out of that history of ideas. It's the application of symbiosis to my vision of a future where we reconnect at all levels, micro, meso and macro, to the rest of life. And we can do this through science. It's not as if it's new. Other cultures, and particularly indigenous cultures, did it through symbolic and intuitive understandings that there's more to life than what you can see. but we've finally nailed it with microscopes. And I'll leave you to read that. At the same time as we discover symbiosis, we discover that our positive earth emotions can be re-injected into a revitalized relationship between humanity and the rest of life. They were always there, these positive earth emotions, and we didn't even need to name them because they were available. They satisfied the principle of plenitude because the earth was not in a state that was putting them into retreat. Although some in English need to be created, and so I've created terms like endemophilia, the love of that which is local to your place. You know, you can have a really intense and powerful relationship there. Eutieria, eu means good, tieria, the earth, I-E-I-A on the end just means a state or a condition. Eutieria is like the Christian and Freudian concept of being at one with the wave or being at one with the totality, that oceanic feeling. So I've too many words there, so I wanted one. So I've got Eutieria. And there's going to be a Eutieria festival in Holland later this year, so keep an eye out for that one. And there are others. I don't want to dwell on them except to say that the Anthropocene generates muicide, which I call the extinction of our emotions. It's not in the presentation. It's not in any dictionary. It's a way of trying to describe the crushing of our emotional responses to what's going on around us. The symbiocene is a way of reviving our positive earth emotions, and that revival, working with science, so good emotions and good science might actually begin to make transformational change. And I don't have time to go through all this, but I just wanted to say that the symbiocene is truly revolutionary. It takes a new look at the foundations of our material life, and everything that we're doing in the Anthropocene now has its opposites. We can discuss some of those things after I run out of time. I'm serious that this could be a geological era as well, because once we start producing things that are non-toxic, non-polluting, et cetera, et cetera, we'll leave, I think it's Crawford Lake in Ontario, Canada, that's used for the Anthropocene. Well, in 50 years' time, we'll go back to Crawford Lake and we'll scoop a bit of mud up and there won't be anything nasty there at all. And that will be the geological commencement of the symbiocene. So I'm trying to outsmart the geologists as well. We will actually have a geological era, not just a philosophically mad creation. It'll have to be taken seriously. So our sense of identity, our emotional compass, our science, our technological outcomes. We're even, the Dutch are leading the world now, mycelium coffins. I've already put an order in for one. If I was rich, I'd actually be part of the crowdfunding to set up the company that's going to produce them. What a market, death. It's never ending. So I can see that this is going to be one of the most successful symbiocene products that you can imagine. The cultural responses to the symbiocene. Instead of yet more apocalyptic novels, poems, dramas, films, you name it, we could actually begin to see a response from the creatives into the domain of the symbiocene as well. I don't have time to talk about symbiocracy, but you could guess that it's not demos, which is of the people. It's rule by the symbios, which is the living together component. I mentioned the symbiocene might be useful in the context of decolonialism, because it's a concept that takes us away from extraction wherever on Earth and brings us very precisely back into particular places on Earth where people have to collaborate to produce their own version of the symbiocene. GEDS, a word that you've never heard of. It means to unite. It's another Indo-European root word. And it's closely connected to words like together, to gather, good. The root word for good is ged. And so I want to replace rights with something much better. And so my work is also going in that direction. And the symbonymy, no one's heard of that. I didn't either until last week when I invented it. It's a form of economy that's going to run according to the principles of the symbiocene. The economy, oikos, is part of the problem. It's made even worse by its movement into ecology, because we've got eco everything now, which means we've got eco nothing. It's such an abused term that it's meaningless. And so spirituality, may the Gedeist be with you. Look it up. And being a practical person, I work with architects. I've convinced a major architectural firm in England to become symbiotechs. Archi means to rule. Texture means to draw or design. Of course, it's a solid patriarchal top-down model of ruling nature. So to become a symbiotech is to begin to draw with the unity of life in mind rather than human dominance or male dominance. And that material that you can see there is furniture and outdoor equipment made out of mycelium bricks and objects. And they're now making houses out of mycelium bricks as well. So, conclusion. It's pretty simple, really. We're in a binary. I don't like binaries, but we're in a bind. We're in a binary. I didn't create it. I don't want it. But we have to now accept that we're in a really difficult position. The Anthropocene as a meme is now versus the symbiocene. Everything that's in the Anthropocene has to be its opposite in the symbiocene. Even the idea that the symbiocene is utopian, I've got a counter to that. Yes, it is, but spell it correctly. It's e-utopia. It means a good future, whereas the Anthropocene has no future. It's a true utopia, as Thomas More wrote about it. And I don't have time to go through the details here, but whatever you think the Anthropocene is, here's a good exercise for you if you're feeling bored. Think of its opposite and you're beginning to get into the symbiocene. And once you start doing that, you'll never get out. It's a conceptual puzzle that suddenly becomes really interesting. I want you to be part of Generation Symbiocene, Gen S. I should have been a marketer in that commercial world. I would have been a millionaire by now. So I spent all my time thinking about concepts that are totally worthless and then give them away. So Generation Symbiocene, I think I wrote about them in Earth Emotions in 2018 when I wrote the book. By 2019, when the book was published, Greta Thunberg was thumping the table and embarrassing the hell out of the power brokers of the world with the truth. And I joined my own grandchildren in school strike for climate change in Newcastle. The other photos of a local anti-coal group called Rising Tide, which stopped the train and stopped the export of coal for a couple of days in Newcastle. So I don't think we've got a choice here. We're in a bind, we're in a binary, and we've got to think our way out of it, and we've got to get our emotional character, our emotional choreography in the right place in order to build, create, co-create the symbiocene. So I leave it with you. I think it's a future worth fighting for. It's a future worth being in. It gives young people something to hope for, not hopium, because this one's based on science. It's not based on some kind of Disneyland. And I would encourage you to see it as a huge collaborative effort on the part of all of you to work together to create something that's going to be worth living in. And so it's our only future, and thank you for being so patient with my very quick delivery.
Thank you very much for this very upbeat, optimistic, and inspiring lecture.
Thank you.
I think, Elise, I would like you to react first. You work at this university as a philosopher, but with the arts faculty, and one of your subjects are, I think they're in English, they're called forest gardens, Voedselbosse, agroforestry. Could you tell a little bit more how that connects to the symbiose scene and to these positive emotions, maybe negative emotions also, that we've just seen?
My research concentrates on food forestry or forest gardens, they are also called. And my interest in that phenomena is mostly because it's a form of active hope. And in that sense, I think that relates to his story, like actually doing something yourself and seeing a landscape change as you're doing it. But also it kind of makes visible the struggle that comes with a paradigm shift, that comes with realizing and coming to terms with what's happening to our landscapes during climate change. I mean, it's not just a story of hope and of solutions or solutionism, right? We're going to plant forests and then we fix everything. You see that people that dab into this kind of design, as it's called, often bring with them old conceptual frames of, for example, agricultural practices of conserving nature, also of capitalism, because in the end people have to make money. So it's like awkward spaces that are also awkward in the sense that it is a symbiosis. Symbiosis as in a living together. You're inviting different creatures into your space, and it's not always pleasant. It's not. It doesn't always go as you envision it or as you want it. And as such, the practice can also confront you with all these conceptual frames that you're using to orientate yourself within the world and to navigate the world. It makes you think, makes you reflect, and which is what I find interesting in the phenomenon.
But so in that sense, it's not just these positive emotions. It's also, in that sense, negative that you're confronted with the boundaries of your own conceptions, of your own. Could you frame that? Is that kind of criticism I hear of the lecture?
No, not per se a criticism as such, but I think multiple things are happening here in the sense that the word solastalgia, the phrase solastalgia, I really like, right? The feeling that you get when you see landscapes that you once knew change in front of your eyes, which creates a negative emotion, an emotion of pain, of mourning. But I think the same can be said for our conceptual worlds, which also are crumbling, you know, are also ripping at the seams. And that also is doing something to us. It's hard to come into terms with the fact that the world as you thought she was, so to say, is also crumbling or also falling apart. It made me think actually of a short story written by Louis Borges. I don't know if people in the Avenue maybe know it. It's called The Rigor of Science, which is a lovely short story and also a nice analogy, I think, to think and talk about what's happening right now. It's a short story that is about map makers, the art of making maps. And actually, these cartographers are so rigorous that they are making a miles-to-miles map of the world. So a one-to-one map takes them a lot of time, of course, because this map covers the whole Earth. So as they are going at it, once they're done, they look up and they see that the huge part of the map already fell apart, right? Because it took so much time to do so. Which is a very nice analogy that you can interpret in many different ways, and it has been interpreted in many different ways by different thinkers as well. But if we relate it to what Glenn was just telling, you could say, like, in this actual story, when the map makers look up, they see that it's not the map per se, or not only the map that is falling apart, it's also the world, right, that the map was covering. That's one part of the story, and that hurts. But if we shift the focus to the map, we see a similar thing happening, namely that the map that we took so much time to make, right, and mapping, you could say language or concepts or metaphors also are a kind of mapping, like it's a way of grasping certain aspects of reality, of orientating ourselves within the world, of navigating her, that map, that very map, is also not referring to anything anymore, because the world that it once referred to is also gone, right? And that's also a kind of hurt that I don't think you made an emotion for yet. Just now I'm looking at you, Gunn.
Example opportunity.
and I don't think that should be underestimated. Well, Nietzsche, one and a half century ago, said a similar thing when the death of God arrived in our culture, and people were saying that yes, we lost faith in God. But Nietzsche pointed out, like, listen, if that's really true, then why are you not behaving like it, mm-hmm. right? If you don't believe this anymore, then why are you not changing your ways?
It's the fact that these conceptual frameworks that we devised in the Anthropocene crumble under our eyes. Is that the reason why we need new concepts and new terms? So your project is to give space, to give words to these emotions, new words. You've already mentioned a lot. You mention a lot more in your book. We literally need a new language. Does that connect with the phenomenon, Elise's?
Well, certainly the dialectic between the old and the new, the falling apart, the repairing, the creating, they're very difficult things to pin down because they're process. They're part of a process philosophy. They're running against the grain of many of the captains of the Anthropocene. So that ship can't be turned easily. Yeah. And what I'm trying to do is provoke the passengers with new language. Yeah. Some of it I don't actually care whether they become part of the official English language or not. They're designed to provoke people, to ask them to question the opposite. So if I'm complaining about rights and I don't have some kind of a comparison which has a name, it makes it difficult to even start the critique. Mm-hmm. But if I can say, well, here's its opposite, I've given it a name, it represents everything that rights in mm-hmm. modern English philosophy anyway represent, all of a sudden there's a space opened up for debate, criticism, renewal that didn't exist before. So what I'm trying to do is not create the past or recreate the past, is to open up new spaces. And there was a wonderful passage that I, in Germaine Greer's book on her patch of rainforest in Australia, where she spent huge amounts of money on mulch and she got, you know, gardeners and equipment and everything. And the Australian brush turkey, who's a mound builder, just ripped it all apart, got rid of all her expensive mulch. And she thought, oh, failed. And then she realised that, no, the turkeys are part of the reconstruction of a rainforest, and that they were part of the workforce. And then she realised that the symbiosis between the turkeys and the earthworms and all the other creatures that were in the rainforest were part of the team helping her rebuild this degraded place. And that's how I think, we can begin to see the reconstruction of a neo-symbiocene, or whatever you want to call it, as an act of creation, but wholly acceptance of the process philosophy that's going on behind it. And so that to me is an illustration of the power of symbiosis and the symbiocene as a metaphor or as a meme to get us thinking about new things. But there are other reasons why we need new language. The existing language is shite. You know, we're still prattling on about sustainability when it's failed for the last 35 years. We're still rabbiting on about resilience when it's become perverse. We're really good at perverse resilience. We're talking about regeneration. Every corporation in the world now is regenerating something, mm-hmm. probably itself. So the language has become useless.
Yeah.
And eco has become a spray-on word for everything.
But aren't you afraid that your new vocabulary might might have the same faith?
Yeah, but I'm going to go down fighting. Also, I got science on my side. They've just got the PR department.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned, I now have to ask you, you mentioned twice your opposition to the term rights. Now, I always thought that rights are beautiful, especially animal rights. And in your native country, in Australia, the rights of a river, actually. So what is wrong with rights and why do we need a new word?
Rights created by John Locke to protect private property from the king, the church, and others that wanted to take private wealth and put it into their hands. It's based on atomism, reductionism, and a worldview which is the very opposite of the symbiocene. It protects mainly the powerful and the rich because we sort out the conflict between rights holders in the courts. It's an adversarial position which further exemplifies the atomism and selfishness of the kind of social structure and corporate structure that we've created. Corporations with rights, what an obscenity. Mm-hmm. So we've now created a system based on rights which is totally incoherent. It's no longer capable of providing us with ethical or legal guidance. It's just a mess that lawyers love. And so let's think of its opposite.
But so animal rights are not okay?
We could protect animals without rights.
Okay.
It's not an essential part of how mm-hmm. we should treat animals.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And in the violation of their rights, we can see, again, the incoherence of the concept. We've had animal rights now for quite some time.
Yeah.
Our treatment of animals really hasn't changed.
No, certainly not in this country. Boris, your research, you're a philosopher at the philosophy department. You work on the philosophy of cli-fi.
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit about that and how this relates to the story of the symbiocene and the positive emotions connected with it?
Yeah, sure. So I work on cli-fi. Cli-fi is short for climate fiction, which are novels that deal with climate change in any way. And there are many, recently there have been written a lot of these novels. And they tie into something you shortly mentioned, that on the one hand, we could hope that literature could help us explore other ways of relating to the planet, maybe even sketching some sort of utopias in the good sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the strange thing is that many stories about climate change are very negative. So they're mostly dystopic in setting. They display a world that's been completely destroyed, in which humans often have not managed to deal with climate change at all. And so this genre seems to mostly be directed at having a sort of wake-up call function for its readers. And we see if we don't act now, we would end up in these horrible worlds in which people are fighting for their life, in which what's left of the government is mostly totalitarian and very oppressive. So they could maybe be sites of renewal in the sense that, well, we see a world that we don't want, so maybe readers are invited to go and explore the symbiocene. But what is strange is that I think if we look at many of these novels, there are exceptions, but most of them end up being rather conservative in the message they send. So even though they project a world like, okay, this is what we don't want, the other side of this message seems to be the world we're in right now, the consumer capitalist system we're functioning in, is the world we need to maintain. So I remember one short fragment in a novel by Emily St. John Mandel, which basically was pages long, ode to the refrigerator and a world in which we could just go to a supermarket and buy food, etc. So the risk of these novels is that they on the one hand seem to scare us away of a future we don't want, but this can end up in a state maybe of eco-paralysis, as you call it, or in a state of just wanting to keep the system we have now and not be open to finding these right and other possible pathways. So, yeah, I'm interested in how literature is trying to navigate this tension and to, on the one hand, create other possibilities, but also not direct us back to the past we already know. It also relates to what you said, Elisa, that we need to have the courage, I think, to really confront some of our dearly held presuppositions. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm not sure if many novels now succeed in doing this in a good way. There are some exceptions, like I said, that really do some innovative work, but often it can end up quite conservative.
Yeah, but so you in these novels, you really do not find much the list of the positive emotions that we saw. It's much more the negative ones. Do I understand it correctly?
Yes, I would say so. Yeah. Right. So sometimes I think at the strongest, most innovative moments, these novels agree that we're in trouble and try to really make us feel what this would mean. And often there are just some small sections of hope, some shimmers of hope, where despite mm-hmm. all the trouble, people manage, for example, to come together and build a new kind of society, a togetherness with other people and other animals. Yeah. And I think those moments can be interesting in as far as they really point forwards towards another way of relating to the world.
Yeah. You're mentioning hope, and I was thinking also while reading the book and also while hearing your lecture, could you say that symbiocene is a hopeful term, a term that contains hope, or is it rather a call to action, or is it the same? So what, and this also relates to the question, all these emotions, and we need new emotions, we need new terms, but don't we need new actions rather than new emotions?
Yep. All of the above. I've read the literature on hopium, so I've stopped using hope.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have radical anticipation for a future which has echoes of radical hope, Jonathan Lear. And the idea of radical hope is of a future that you don't even have any idea of, or you may not have any idea of, but nevertheless it's motivation to move into a different and new state that has some continuity with the past. My radical anticipation is to have a vision of a future that's so appealing that you want to get to it as fast as possible. Yeah. And so the hopium literature is pretty powerful. I don't think I have hope. I think I have a vision of a future that's worth living in, and one that's going to require a huge amount of work and effort and the contradictions and stresses that will take. I mean, the book declares World War III, so I do agree that there's going to be conflict between creative and destructive emotions, and that this is pretty much inevitable. But it's a war of emotions. It's not a war of guns and bombs. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of hope, I think, has been corrupted, a bit like sustainability. Probably the two go together. And I'd like to present other ways of thinking about, anticipation of change is a better way of thinking about the predicament that we're in now than hoping for hope. However, I am hopeful. I am an optimist. I'm also a bird lover. So I've got so many bad things going for me.
Which is why we invited you tonight. But now hope is also a religious, theological term even. In your book, you have a whole chapter on a new form of spirituality, but you wanted to have a secular spirituality. Mm. I was wondering why it should be secular and couldn't hope function in this secular spirituality that you're talking of?
Well, it probably could, but my brain just doesn't go in that direction. I think what I'm trying to suggest is that the story of symbiosis, the microcosmos, is so interesting, and the idea of interconnectedness now has so much more meat on it at the micro level, that this story of interconnectedness, the sharing of the force of life, the bio-communion, I call it, is such a an amazing discovery that humans have made about the life from which we have emerged ourselves, that it's inherently spiritual. So it's us looking at life and trying to come up with an account, which is similar to traditional and indigenous views, but it's not institutionalized through churches. I think the churches have a role in a communal and you know aspects of religiosity that I'm perfectly happy for other people to be engaged in. But for me, the need for a spirituality which is separate from institutional churches, past dogma and text, is not. I think I want it because I think it's part of the human condition to have this spirituality connected to their lives, something, the search for meaning to be part of something greater than oneself. Mm-hmm. Well, we did search for meaning in the big tree, the big church, the big man, but it's proven to be so disappointing and such a failure that a secular spirituality, I call it the Gedeist, so the word Ged comes up again. I've shortened it and got rid of a few letters to and shoved the Geist in at the end of it. It's that spiritual feeling that we're united to each other in the rest of life. So again, I not a lot of take up on that concept, but it's something which I put as a chapter in the book to develop the connection between spirituality and ethics. So the idea that I want is more of a symbiosis based on spirituality and ethics rather than just it being a material science that tells us about interconnections. There's got to be a meaning there, and that search for meaning is what spirituality conventionally has attempted to achieve. I just want to get away from the big church and start looking at my microbiome. Actually, the microbiome turns out to be much more interesting than the contents of the church.
Okay. there's a lot of, I think this is also a lot of spirituality surrounding this whole forest garden movement. Do you recognize aspects of this secular spirituality?
Yes, I would say so, which is coming, I think, mostly from like an embodied experience of exactly that, being part of something bigger than just you, including also realizing that, you know, you are a multitude and there's a microbe in you, like people that start dabbing into permaculture, for example, and food forestry, they often start with a liking for plants, for example, or birds, you know, like you want to plant something, so to bring back insects or birds, or because you want food and you like apples, so you want to plant a tree. And then through that opening, so to say, to a new ecology, they often end up in the soil, because once you start realizing that plants have roots that go into the ground and that there's a lot of things going on there, a whole new world opens that then also connects to your own microbe, you know, because you're eating stuff and it actually changes how you feel and how you act and whatnot. So it's an active kind of spirituality, like an embodied experience of that connection that you have, which is, again, not always positive, right? It also can be awkward. It can be painful. In some of the worst cases, even deadly. Interspecies symbiosis is not always just and they lived happily ever after, right? It can also be kind of gruesome. And you learn that too. So you're also confronted with that and with plagues and with critters that you wish would not come to the food forest, and you have to adapt to that. You have to start seeing yourself and your role within that ecosystem also. You start seeing it in a different light, so to say.
Mm-hmm. And in your Cli-Fi, secular spirituality?
Not secular, I think, just full-on organized spirituality, religious spirituality. So indeed, the moments of renewal that I spoke about that sometimes do take place in these novels are very often organized about the founding of a new religion or the founding of a more earth-attuned religion and forms of instituting that. And one interesting example, a very nice climate change novel called A Children's Bible, features a child who has a children's Bible and uses that to interpret the ongoing climate change around him, coming to a completely different understanding of what needs to, he tries to save all the animals like Noah, and he thinks that he needs to decode the Holy Trinity. I don't know exactly what the code is, but science comes to take the place of the Holy Spirit or something like that. So this is an interesting way to renew also our understanding of religious that we have and use them maybe as a new lens also to see what needs to be done. And I think in these novels, religion plays a large role often because they're also a test of the limits of what humans can do and control. So they are often about the failure of previous collective action within the system we know now. And so if there's room in these novels for a change, very often it has to do with a sort of moment from the outside in which some kind of spiritual or religious change prepares a new future. So, yeah.
And it makes sense. And if we talk about spirituality, you begin your book and throughout your book you make a lot of references to the Aboriginal people of Australia. You did so in your lecture as well, briefly, and their spirituality, so to speak, their dream, their dreamers. Mm-hmm. If you look at the fate of the Aboriginals in Australia, there's very little hope that you can derive from that. And there's very much also colonization, very much the gesture of the Anthropocene, the destruction of their natural life, destruction of the way they live together with nature, with each other, and in symbiosis. That gets one not very hopeful, doesn't it?
No. I think that's true, what you said, up to maybe 10, 15 years ago. What I've observed in Australia is a revival of Aboriginality in the sense that traditional ecological knowledge is now being accepted as part of a contemporary scientific approach to, for example, environmental management, fire stick farming, or what's called cultural burning, so that you actually learn from Indigenous people about how to use fire to control wildfire. And we have this huge problem with wildfire. Yeah. There's also the rise of Indigenous writers, thinkers, academics who are no longer silent about the colonial project. They're really very vocal about what went wrong, who's responsible. They're not all that interested in going to the courts to fight for their rights for land, even though we have this land rights movement. Yeah. They've moved on, and I think in all domains of human enterprise, and that includes art in all of its creative forms, there's been this massive revival of what I would call an emergent hybrid Indigenous culture. And so I think the movement now is for the non-Indigenous people of Australia to move in their direction. Yeah. And so we have an emergent hybrid culture that has the best of both worlds, as it were. And you have Australian authors like Tyson Yukapunda and others who are doing their level best to try and bridge the two culture problem. And I think they're succeeding in every domain. I don't formally supervise postgrad students anymore, but I informally supervise quite a number of Indigenous scholars who are looking for new ways of taking their traditional dreaming and other beliefs. The idea of song lines is closely connected to the symbioscene and many of its secular spiritual aspects. And so I take that as a good sign that the symbioscene as a concept is so inclusive that Indigenous people can also use it in a way that is bridging, is transformational for themselves, particularly young Indigenous scholars are just really doing amazing things in Australian universities. So what you said is perfectly true, and maybe I'm being ridiculously optimistic in saying it stopped in its tracks about 15 years ago, and that's it's now moving on. But I think I'm on solid ground when I'm putting this thesis or counter-thesis to you. It's moving so rapidly that I don't know if I can even give a decent account of the change. But this emergent hybrid culture has emerged.
Yeah.
It has its leaders, it has its intellectual leaders, it has its political leaders. It's also incorporated female indigenous scholarship in a way that was invisible or not possible in the past. So there's a lot happening in that space. And my affinity with Australian Indigenous people was similar to that of Aline Mitchell's. We came in 1788, and in a relatively short period of time, we've done so much damage that it's almost breathtaking.
Yeah.
The Indigenous people of Australia lived, it's accepted, for approximately 80,000 years on mainland Australia and Tasmania, and worked out an ethic, a spirituality, cultural practices that ensured continuity over time. Well, that's a hell of a lot better than what we've managed in 300 years of the Industrial Revolution, where we've now reached the point where we can see the destruction of our own culture. Mm-hmm. Well, we're dumbasses, you know. Yeah. They had it worked out in a form that was successful for them. It's not possible to go back to a hunting and gathering culture with 8 billion plus people on the earth. So this emergent hybrid culture is going to have to be far different in its uptake. And to give you an example, I work with Indigenous people in Arnhem Land on various projects, and I took photos with permission, their permission on their land, and offered to send them back prints when I got back to Newcastle and the university. Nah, mate, just send it on a DVD. And they were running their DVD player on solar power in the remotest part of Australia. So, you know, this idea that they're not likely to move into this emergent hybrid space, they want it. Yeah. And they're smarter at it than we are in many respects. So they pioneered many of the technologies that we now proudly call alternative technology. Mm-hmm. It just came easy to them. Yeah. So you were correct. And I think we have to watch this space because it's emergent.
Mm-hmm. And this is really about much more than land rights,
it's
much further than that.
Oh, look, there's dance, there's art, there's numerous projects that are creative, and you know the idea of purpose now is being driven by Indigenous entrepreneurs as well. So we're seeing business people starting up new businesses, new entrepreneurial activity, not because they just want money, but they want to connect the making of money and having an income with doing something which makes sense in their traditional and ongoing culture. It's not dead. And so I believe that's a viable way for all humans to go. And it's testimony to the strength of Indigenous people in Australia, because they've gone through hell.
Yeah, absolutely.
To give an example of that hell in the Hunter Valley, the people who were, I wouldn't want to call them racist openly, but they didn't hold positive views of Aboriginal people. They sure did once they got colonised by the coal industry. Ah, that's what it feels like to be colonised. That's what it's like to have your land taken away.
Yeah.
That's what it's like to have everything that you value in your land around you being smashed. And so there was this instant affinity to a culture that had previously been either ignored or severely negatively evaluated. I guess everything that you understand under the concept of racism, not just different, but inferior.
Look, this is a colonizing nation as well. So,
Well, I'm a product of your colonization. So, I'm thankful for your invasion of Sri Lanka. I'm thankful for your battles with the Portuguese. I'm also part Portuguese. Same mob, all went to Ceylon. So, my father was born in Colombo in Ceylon. So, this is now the world we live in. I'm a I'm a world person with a passionate interest in particular places.
First of all, thank you very much, Boris and Elise, for your contribution.
Thank you.
But very much thanks to Glenn for his presence here, the wonderful lecture and your answers to the questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.